first of all, thank Dori again for her time. And also at the end, we'll hopefully have some time for questions. I think that's going to have to work is you'll have to just say the question and I'll repeat it in case it's not heard through the, because I'm talking to her through the Zoom. And I'm just going to make her the speaker. Here we are. And whenever you're ready, take it away. Give me 1 second.
Thank you. Can you hear me? We're good to go?
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, good morning in Sydney. It's evening here. I actually was in Sydney years ago. I was 17 years old and I just loved Bondi Beach and loved playing around with the accent. So it's nice to see Sydney in this format now. So many years ago, my oldest grandson, 8 years ago, my oldest grandson, his name is Mayer. And when he was 5 years old, his parents had to switch him from a little preschool that he had gone to, you know, kind of like the, almost like a playgroup type situation, because he was little, he went to school very close to home. And then when he got older, he turned 5, he had to go to what they call like the big boy school, the yeshiva. And they live in London, in Hendon. And the yeshiva that he was going to is in Stamford Hill. And it's about 45 minutes to an hour from where they live. So here we have this little 5-year-old boy, and he's so used to going very close to home in a very small and nurturing little play group. And all of a sudden he's going to this really, really big school, almost an hour from home. And the school, what they did was they took, it's in London. So they took one of those, you know, those iconic double-decker red school buses. So they managed to get one and they privatized it. And that was the school bus. And little Mayer, 5 years old, he's going to the big school. But the first day of school, my daughter decided it would be better if she dropped him off. So she drove him to the school and she told him, when school is over, you're going to go on the bus and I'm going to be waiting for you at the bus stop. But after she dropped him off and she's watching him walk away, he's her oldest, and she thought, you know, he's so young and it's very overwhelming, big school. And on top of that, the bus and the bus stop, it really would be better for him if she takes him home in the car. And like this, also they can talk about the day, they can process it. So she decided that she's going to take him home by car instead of the bus. She lives almost an hour away, so it didn't pay for her to go back and forth. So she made arrangement for her other son and she stayed the entire day in Stamford Hill just so she could drive little Mayer home and talk to him in the car on the first day of school. And at 4 o'clock, when school is over, she runs out to meet him, and little Mayer is coming out together with all his friends. And she says to him, "Hi, Mayer, mommy's here. I came to take you home." And Mayer starts to cry. "I want to go on the bus." And she said, "Okay, tomorrow you'll go on the bus, but I came to take you. I waited all day, came to take you home." Mayer cried so hard, his shirt was wet. "Bus, bus, I want to go on the bus." And the whole ride home, well over an hour in traffic, every time my daughter tried to ask him, "Mayer, how was your day? And, you know, what did the teacher say?" Anytime she tried to ask him anything, Mayer had his hands over his ears and he was screaming, "Bus, bus, I want to go on the bus." And when my daughter told me this, I said, "You know, I really get it. Here's what happened. Mayer thought he's going on the bus because that's the plan. That's what they told him. You're going on the bus. He wanted to go on the bus. Show me a 5-year-old who's never been on a red double-decker bus, doesn't want to go on the bus." And Mayer saw the other kids going on the bus. So even though his mom really knew what was better for him, if he's so busy screaming about wanting to go on the bus, he can't even benefit from the other plan, from the quiet car. Story of my life. I thought it would go a certain way. I wanted it to go a certain way. I see other people who have what I thought I would get and wanted to get. But my God said to me, "For you, something a little different, something quieter, something different, not what you thought, not what you wanted, not what other people have. But if I'm so busy, hands over my ears, tantruming about what I didn't get, I can't benefit from that which my God knows is better for me." So here's my story. My husband and I are married 38 years. He's a rabbi, you know, rabbis and then lots of kids. We had children 3 and 3 years. I was pregnant with number 4 when my oldest was 4. Our first 3 kids were healthy. Our 4th child was born looking perfectly normal, but very weak. And the doctors had never seen anything like it. And the only thing they could call it was basically failure to thrive, meaning this is a baby that's not doing what babies are supposed to do. To make a very long story short, we had 8 children. And of the 8 children, 4 of them were born with a very unusual disorder. We didn't know what it was until we had most of our kids. And that's when we learned our kids were very sick. The ones that had this disorder, it was half of them. So we had 4 healthy kids and 4 kids with this really rare disorder where they're unable to turn food into energy. Generally, the way that our bodies work is our food breaks down in the Krebs cycle. It's a mitochondrial disorder and it turns food into energy. My babies were missing one enzyme. You know how people say, I don't have energy? We have energy. I know what it looks like when someone really doesn't have energy. Their bodies couldn't manufacture energy. And over a period of 10 years, we had 4 kids like this, 4 healthy kids and 4 kids like this. And in the end, those 4, they didn't survive. It's a fatal disorder. They died very young. And we just always refer to them as the babies. And we had 4 healthy kids, which is why it was very, very important for me and my husband that people not look at us. And I don't know an English word for this. So I'll give you the Yiddish. The word is nebuch, kind of like that poor thing, a poor, unfortunate thing. I didn't want people looking at me and at my children and saying, oh, you see that family? They have another of those very, very sick kids. Or after the babies died, we didn't want people saying, oh, you see them? Half their kids died. We didn't want to be that. And we worked really, really hard on it. Me and my husband, I went back to school. I got a degree, another degree. I went into education. We invited lots of guests. We created a home. And my kids tell me now, a happy home, a warm home. There was sadness, but it was not what we were about. We would not be Nebuch. The people would look at us and that's the first thing that would come to mind. And we raised our kids, a son, 3 daughters. And our son, Yossi was a very unusual kid, our oldest. He was a lover of nature. From the time he was a little boy, couldn't pass an animal without touching it and stars and everything about nature, grass. So he was just the kind of kid that just was interested in nature. He was also a real learner, you know, like very much. He would sit not with 1 or 2 books. He also would sit with 10 or 20, particularly Hebrew books. He loved like history, Jewish law, and he would just write his little notes on the side. He was a smart kid. He loved words. He loved to play with words. He loved to laugh. And Yossi loved his mom. And when Yossi was 23 years old, he got a job in Costa Rica as a learning director. And his job was to teach. It was a camp and his job was to teach. But because he was in the camp, he got to go on the trips. And one of the trips was scuba diving. And Yossi was not a very adventurous kid. He was kind of, I don't know if you use that word in Australia, but here we say like a nerdy kind of a kid, very bookish. He wasn't into sports, but they took the camp scuba diving. And Yossi absolutely fell in love, not with the sport itself, but with what he saw under the water. And he got very interested in diving just to see there was nature and glorious nature. So he came back to Los Angeles. We live in California. He came home after the summer and he was interested in continuing to scuba dive. And in the process, he was 23. Yossi got engaged and we started to prepare for his wedding. It was a Friday afternoon and I was a principal of a junior high school. So every morning I would collect the whole junior high school. And right before we did our prayers, I would say a little short little word of inspiration. There's a Jewish book called Hayom Yom. It's written by the previous Chabad Rebbe. And it has like a little saying for each day. And it goes by the Hebrew calendar, which means that the saying on a particular day in the Hebrew calendar will always be the saying of that day. So according to the Hebrew calendar, this was Friday. And the Hebrew date was the 28th of the month of Cheshvan. And that day I stood in front of my junior high school and I said the saying of that day, and here's what it is. Divine providence. Nothing in the world moves or is without it being directed by God. And every single movement of every single creature, not only is it directed by God, but it's part of the master plan of creation. When God created the world, every movement. And the Rebbe writes there that this includes even the movement of a blade of grass. It's part of the master plan. Every animal, and if this is true of plants and of creatures, how much more so the movement of a human being? Now, if you would have stopped me that day, on that Friday, on the 28th of Cheshvan, and asked me, what you just taught right now about divine providence, that nothing happens without God and everything is part of the plan. You believe that? And I would have said yes. So then there's no such thing as an accident. If everything is orchestrated by God, then even our mistakes and even the things that we do wrong, nothing is an accident. You believe that? I would have said yes. I just taught it. There's no such thing as an accident. And that Friday before I left school, my Yossi's fiance's mother called me and we went over the proof for the invitation. The wedding was a few weeks away and we actually proofed the final version for the invitation for Yossi's wedding. And then I went home. It was Friday. I started to cook for Shabbat. And that's when I got the call. Yossi had been going for his diving certification that day and something went wrong. They had to pull him from the water. The police called my husband. My husband called me and he came home to get me. And we went to the hospital. And on the way to the hospital, you know, I took a book of Psalms with me. That's our first go-to is we pray. But I couldn't open it because the whole way to the hospital, I kept just repeating the same thing again and again and again. I kept saying, this is not the babies, this is Yossi. I was reminding God, I was reminding myself that my kids are divided into two. I have four healthy kids, I have four sick kids. The healthy kids are alive and well. The sick kids died. And you know how you get that when something very, very big has happened to you in your life and you figure, okay, I did mine. I was the woman who lost half my kids over 10 years. And I said it very quickly here, but it wasn't big. I mean, it wasn't small at all. It was very, very, very big. It was that we went through a lot of medical research. It really was 10 years of heavy involvement in what was going on with our babies and making sure that our other children were safe. And with that whole loss came also, I was in my early 30s when we finally knew what our odds are. Our odds, by the way, are 25% chance for a sick child, 75% chance for a healthy child. But we knew, my husband and I, that we couldn't have any more children because even though they're good odds, when a sick child is born, the toll that it takes on the family. So I had been really young when I not only lost half my children after years of hospitalizations and research, but I knew I couldn't have any more children. And we made the decision to raise our four and make it as good a childhood as we could. So on the way to the hospital now, I'm reminding God, I did my big thing already. The worst that could happen happened. This is not the babies. This is Yossi. He's the healthy one. The healthy ones live. And I'm saying it again and again and again. And then when I got to the hospital, the doctors came in and they told us that they said we did everything we could and we're so sorry. And just like that, we lost Yossi. We found out later that they tried really, really hard to save him, but they couldn't. And Yossi had drowned. It was very close to Shabbat. We had to go home. There was nothing we could do for him in the hospital. And we had to go home. We came home. And before I had gotten the call, I had already set my table for Shabbat. So we light candles for every child. So I have this gorgeous big silver candelabra with 8 candles for my 8 children. Because I lit for the babies too. They were alive. While they were alive, we lit and we continue to light for them. Because every soul that comes in this world brings light. So I've got this gorgeous candelabra with 8 candles. And next to it, I've got another 2 for me and my husband. So when you look at this table, the Shabbat table, you've got 10 beautiful, you know, silver candles going. And then I also, when Yossi was a little boy, I had learned that oil is a symbol of warmth and light. And if you light oil on Friday for Shabbat, it's a merit to have a child, a son who will be a Torah scholar. So from the time Yossi was a little boy, I also lit 2 beautiful oil lights. So I come home and there's my table. Shabbat is coming in minutes. 10 candles and 2 oils. And I look at that table set for Shabbat because we had done it before we got the call. And I'm thinking, I can't do it. I cannot light these candles. And I've been lighting candles pretty much all my life, but I cannot light the Shabbat candles. Most of my kids are dead. I'm not lighting candles for a nice family. And then I looked at the oils for a son who's a Torah scholar. I have one son. I don't have a son anymore. And I said, I just can't. This week, I cannot light the candles. But here's the thing. See, I told you about the Hayom Yom, the diary of each day. So there's one for my Hebrew birthday that comes out the same every year on my Hebrew birthday. And that one says that the mitzvah, a good deed that we do, we call it a commandment, a mitzvah that we do, we don't do a mitzvah when we're feeling inspired or we're feeling good about it. The word mitzvah comes from the word safsa, safsa v'chibur. It means connection. We do a mitzvah, which is a commandment, what God asks of us, because God says We used to be able to say this, we don't say it anymore, but God says, because I said so. That's it, because I said so. When I tell you to do this and you do it, you connect to me. So we don't light candles or pray or keep Shabbat or any of those things because we feel inspired or because we understand how good it is to have spirituality in our lives. I mean, there is a lot of benefit to a spiritual life, but we do it simply because God said so. I looked at those candles. It's an easy thing to light candles. It was the hardest thing I had ever done. I lit the candles. My hand was shaking. I lit those candles. 8 candles for 8 children, candle for me and my husband, oil lights for my son. And we had Shabbat. And on Sunday, we buried Yossi in the same cemetery that already had our 4 babies. We buried Yossi exactly 6 weeks to the day from the day he was supposed to get married. People ask me all the time, how? How do you do it? So we learn a lot about spirituality, about God, about closeness. There's a lot of answers. The question is, why does it have to be so far from us? God and all these, this concept of spirituality, it's in the books. It's in the minds and the talks of the rabbi. But how do we make it real? Why is it so removed? Why is it that what we experience is what's right in front of us? We could taste what we're eating. We could feel the pain that we have. We feel this material world, but we don't feel the spirituality. So how do we go through something difficult from a spiritual point? Why is it that God is so, you could say, hard to grasp? So one of the students of the holy Baal Shem Tov came to him with this question. He said, you know, and these are people who are so spiritual, learning about God all day. And he said, I don't feel God close to me. And sometimes I feel it for a bit. I think we all have that, those moments when we feel very inspired and close. And then I lose it. Why? Why don't I feel God? So then I can go through whatever I'm going through. Why can't I feel God more clearly, more close to me? And the holy Baal Shem Tov said to him, think about the way that a parent is teaching a child how to walk. So the parent stands the child up and the child is ready to take a step. And as soon as the child is ready to take a first step, the parent steps backwards. The child takes a step and the parent takes another step backwards. And the Baal Shem Tov asked, why? Why would a parent step away from a child? And the Baal Shem Tov explained, because the child and the parent want two different things. The child wants, pick me up, hold me, carry me. Don't we all? Who doesn't want that? Carry me, take care of me, God, make it all good for me. You carry me around. But the parent wants the child to know that he knows how to walk. The parent wants the child to know that he knows how to walk. So he steps away. We walk. Look at us. We walk. Each one of us with our own stories, our own pain, our own sadness. We walk. We find out that we can walk. The parent is right there. We are never, never alone. So how do we do it? How do we reconcile what I want and what feels like would be a good life with the reality that God sometimes says, you're not going on the bus? How do we do that? How do we reconcile it? How do we have a joyous life when we're in pain, when we're scared, when we're frustrated, when we're lonely, when we're sad? There's so many ways of feeling pain. So it helps to understand what the whole point of being in this world is. What is this journey really about? A few weeks before Yossi died, he was helping me. We were hanging up some photos from my daughters. My two daughters had gotten married, and then I had the younger one. He was helping me to hang the photos from their weddings on the wall. So he hung up one, then he hung up the other, and there was an empty space on the wall. And yes, he was engaged at that point already, so he was very excited, and he was in general like enthusiastic. So he kind of danced over to the wall, and he stuck his hand, like he took his hand, and he like smacked it against the wall, and he said, here, my wedding picture will go here. Now, this is the part where I want to tell you that I smiled at him and I said, yes, your wedding picture will go here and I'm so happy and I love you. That would have been nice, but that's not really what happened. Here's what actually happened. Yossi danced over to the wall, smacked his hand on the wall and said, here, my wedding picture will go here. And I said, get your filthy hand off the wall. And when Yossi took his hand off the wall, I said, look, you left the mark. Yossi, I guess his hand had been a little sweaty and the hammer must have been a little dusty. On the wall was a perfect handprint. You could actually see the whole handprint. And after he died, I was obsessed with that handprint. I would bring everybody over to it and say, look, what's more real than the hand? Like, I had a son. Here is the mark of a boy who was so excited about getting married that he stuck his hand on the wall. And here is the mark of a mom who thought it was a big deal that there was a dirty handprint on the wall. And I was obsessed with it. I told my husband, we're never going to wash it. We're never going to paint over it. We washed it. We painted over it. Because in time, I came to understand Yossi's mark on the wall, that's not the mark that he was here. Not at all. The mark that he was here is the love that he had for others, the great wisdom. He was really a deep scholar, and the learning and the kindness and the joy he took in life. See, all of us too, we go through this world. We may leave a mark, a handprint. We may build a castle. We may own an empire. But that's not really the mark we leave on this world. The mark that we leave, and we take it with us. We change the world, but we change ourselves. And it's at soul level, so it comes with us. It's the good that we do. It's the kindness that we show. It's the learning that we do. It's the efforts that we make. That's the mark. Now, this all sounds really good and nice and, you know, the mark and spiritual. But what if we're saying no? No. No, I don't want this. I don't want to have this difficulty. So when one of my babies was in the hospital, she was the sickest child in the hospital. She was dying. And because we had other kids at home, we would shift off. So I would go in and out. My husband would go, and we had a lot of friends who would go. So once when it was my shift and I was going to the hospital, before I went up to be with her, I went into the bathroom in the lobby. And I don't know if you have it in Australia, but in America, they have it in a lot of the bathrooms. When you're in the bathroom, there's a sign and it says baby changing station. And I looked at that baby changing station and something hit me. And I thought, that's exactly what I need. I need a baby changing station. I want to change my baby. And I started to cry. And I started to talk to God, yes, in the bathroom by the baby changing station. And I'm crying like a lunatic. And I'm saying, God, I want to change my baby. I don't want this baby. I want to change my baby for a baby that works. And I'm crying and I'm crying. But after a while, you know, you got to get on with business. I washed my face. I went upstairs to my baby. And it was quite a production. She was really sick. So I had to scrub up to keep her protected from germs. And she was intubated. So it was a whole job to pick her up and hold her. But finally, I've got my baby in my arms. And the thing about my babies, she was a few months old at that point. They grew at a regular rate and they looked like normal babies, which some people say was a good, was it not good? It's what God did. But they looked beautiful. They didn't look different than any other child. And they also, their growth was normal. The development, not, but the growth, yes. So I'm holding this beautiful little baby and her hair was just starting to curl. She was about 4.5 months old. So they get really cute at that point. And I'm looking down at her and I have this is going to sound really a little bit insane, but I had this thought. We don't get to change the baby. We have to keep him. Imagine you're going, you know, your parent in school and your kid acts out. So you tell the teacher, you know what? That kid is too much trouble. Give me another kid. We understand it doesn't work like that. We don't get to change the baby, but I had it at a whole nother level. Just to give you backdrop so you don't say, oh, she's so spiritual, she's so strong. I was a mess when my babies were sick. I was very young. I was 24 when my first sick child was born. I was very, very anxious. Every time the phone rang, I jumped. Having a sick kid in the hospital would do that. I was angry. I was angry that my kids were sick, more than one. I was bitter. I was jealous. I couldn't look at other people's healthy babies. But against that backdrop, I want to tell you about a beautiful moment. That day, after I had my whole crying jag in the bathroom, I want to change my baby. I'm holding my baby. And I want to tell you about a moment of transcendence. I apologize. The phone is ringing somewhere and it's not my house. So I don't even know how to get it. Transcendent moment. I recognize something. We don't get to change the baby, meaning this child, she's on a soul journey. She's dying. She's not going to know who I am. She's not going to call me mommy. She's not going to smile at me. At that point, she was really dying. I'm never going to get to benefit from her being my child. And yet I have to show up at the hospital because, first of all, I want the doctors and the nurses to know that this is an important baby. But more than that, even though she's dying, at this moment, at this moment, if I can hold her, I can offer her some human touch. She can hear my voice. I can give her some comfort at this time. And it gave me the idea, like just that sense of it's unconditional love. It's love with no expectation of getting anything back. And it was not a negative feeling. It was really a wow moment. I wasn't like that all the time, you know, but at that moment, I had this sense of something bigger than me. And I'm the kind of person that I like everything to make sense. Like if I'm going to spend time, it has to have a good reason. I like to figure out how to make the best use of everything. And here I was sitting in a hospital holding an unresponsive child with technically no benefit. She's dying. But I had this feeling at that moment, not just that we don't get to change the baby, that I'm stuck with her, but bigger than that. We don't get to change the baby because her soul journey and mine and my husband's, we're all connected. My husband and I, we're the ones that are escorting this precious life into this world and I knew out of this world. But at this time now, it felt kind of like a forever bond, like our souls would be touching. I had a sense that at some time, at a soul level, it would be a moment that would come back to me. It's just a feeling of bigger. We don't get to change the baby. We don't get to change our circumstances because they're perfect for our soul development. They're perfect for us becoming who we have to be. So here's how it works. Tough stuff happens to us. We have to accept. No choice, right? We have to accept. Not enough. It's not enough to accept it, to say, okay, God, I'll stop screaming. No, no, no. It's not enough. We have to grow. We have to become better people. We have to do something good from it. Not enough. God wants something else. God wants us to have joy. Not just to say, okay, fine, I'll be saddled with this, or fine, I'll be a better person. I have no choice either in that. No, no, no. We have to have joy. My husband, great guy, but I don't like when he comes into the kitchen. And sometime after Yossi died, I was cooking for Shabbat and my husband comes into the kitchen. I was making eggplant and he says to me, why are you putting so much salt? This is why I don't like him in the kitchen. So I said to him, don't worry, I'm going to rinse it. This is how my mother does it. But he says, but why so much salt? So I said to him, because when you salt eggplant, you're getting a cooking tip here. When you salt eggplant before you cook it, it takes away the bitterness. So I put the salt, take away the bitterness. And all of a sudden I'm in my kitchen in sunny California. And I feel like white flakes coming down over my head and my shoulders. And I turn around. My husband is holding the salt shaker, shaking, shaking over my head. And he says, to take away the bitterness. Because we have to have joy. We can't have a Judaism that's forced or resentful or heavy. We won't get far like that. We have to have joy. The first Chabad Rebbe, Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, he writes, here's why joy is so important. He says, imagine you have two wrestlers and they're going to fight, but one of them is very well-trained and he's stronger. He's easily going to win. The problem is that he's feeling very sad. And because he's so sad, it saps his energy. It makes him sluggish. It makes him lethargic. So even though he's stronger and even though he's better trained, he's not going to win because his sadness is pulling away. It's making him just sluggish and not able to move well. Life is a struggle. Stuff happens to us from outside of us, stuff that we can't help. Stuff happens to us from inside of us, our own vulnerabilities, our own mistakes, our own choices, our own just the way that we are. We're fragile and stuff happens and we have to struggle. As a nation, we have to struggle. As individuals, we have to struggle. If we come at it from a sluggish place, from a place of sadness, from a place of being forced into it, we won't have the energy. In Hebrew, the word is chayus. It means like the lift, the up, the life, and we won't be able to win. So how do we do it? How do we find joy? So I'm going to talk about joy at two levels, a basic level and a little deeper. Here's the basic one. The night before Yossi died, it was a Thursday night, and I was already preparing for Shabbos. I was starting to cook, working mom. I had to cook Thursday night also. And Yossi came into the kitchen and supposedly he came in to help me, but really I was cooking and he was eating and talking. And Yossi tells me, he was a 23-year-old Talmudic scholar. He says to me, he's nervous, he tells me, because he's going to get married. He's going to live in New York. He says, I'm going to have an apartment and there's all these things in this kitchen and I don't even know what they are. And like, how am I going to do this? And he was only half joking. And I said to him, Yossi, I'm coming to New York in 2 weeks. It's the greatest pleasure for a parent to set up a child. I'm going to get you, I'm going to go shopping with your fiance. I'm going to get you all these things and you're going to learn how to use them. It's exciting. You're going to have everything you need. So he kind of calmed down. And then he started to joke around because that was very much Yossi. And he said, you know what, Mom? You've got all this great stuff right here. Why don't I just take from here? So I was joking around with him too. I said, okay, you know, just let me know what you want. And then I was really busy. I wasn't really paying attention to him. And I'm cooking and I'm not watching him so much. And then, and he was busy. And then I look up and I see Yossi had taken post-it notes, you know, yellow post-it notes, a lot of yellow post-it notes. And on every one of them, he had written his name and the name of his fiance. Everywhere in my kitchen, my fridge, my stove, every drawer, every chair, every appliance, everything has on it a yellow post-it note with Yossi's name and his fiance. And he says to me, here, I marked what I'm taking. And we're laughing and I'm looking around the kitchen. He's taking everything. And I see like his name and her name all over the kitchen. And I said to him, I was just talking. And I said to him, Yossi, isn't it amazing that someone who you didn't know for most of your life is soon going to be the most important person in the world to you? And he said to me, you're the most important person in the world to me, Mom. And I said, Yossi, you're getting married. If your mother's the most important person in the world to you, we might have a problem. But Yossi was 23. You know, when you're 23, you know everything. And he said to me, no, don't worry, Mom. My marriage, that's another story. But right now in this kitchen, you're the most important person in the world to me. And he died the next day. But I want to tell you about the rest of the conversation, because after that, Yossi got serious and he told me that after he's married, he wants to come home and spend all the Jewish holidays in our house with his wife, with his family. And he started to tell me how much he loved the Jewish holidays in our house. And he was kind of, it was a thank you, but a serious one. And it made such an impact on me, because from the time Yossi was 4 until he was 14, for those 10 years, we had sick children. And you know, when you're going through a hard time, people think it's the sad times that are hard. It's the happy times that are hard. The holidays were the hardest for me, because holidays are about family and children. And I had either sick children or, you know, children who had just died. And the holidays were really, really challenging for me. But here's the flip side of it. Although people would have understood if I would have said I'm not doing the holidays, or I'm locking myself in my room, or I'm not getting out of bed, no one would have judged me. But meanwhile, I had 4 kids at home. And here's the hard part about when you have kids and you're going through a hard time, or anyone who loves you and you're going through a hard time, you don't get to put their lives on pause while you deal and then come back. So I had 4 kids in the house. And while I was understandably having a hard time with the holidays, they were having their childhood right then. So I needed to pull it together so that I wouldn't, you know, cause them to lose out. So the holidays were the hardest time for this. So what I did was, it's a little bit my personality, I went to the other extreme. Every time we came to a Jewish holiday, I would go insane on the food. I would just make it very, very festive. And I would invite lots of people, sometimes even 40 people to my house, you know, kind of rent a crowd kind of thing. But just to make it very festive and to make it very nice. At our house, the holidays are super nice as a way of counteracting my sadness. But I always worried that even with all my efforts, that somehow my kids would still, I mean, they had a mom who was sad a lot. There was no way to sugarcoat that, all the effort in the world. There was sadness. And I worried that it would impact them. But here was my son, 23 years old. I had not asked him. And he was telling me seriously how much he appreciated that we had made nice holidays. And it was a recognition of how hard it had been and that we gave him that. And it was such a beautiful moment of joy. Yossi died almost 14 years ago, and I still feel the joy of that moment. So on a very basic level, you want joy? Acknowledge the good. Tell someone who's done something for you how grateful you are. It'll bring joy to you. It'll bring joy to them. And we think, they know. No, you have to tell them. There was a couple who was married for many years, and they went to a marriage counselor, and the wife complained. And she said, my husband never tells me that he loves me. So the marriage counselor turned to the husband and said, is that true? And he said, look, 30 years ago, I told her I love her. If anything changes, I'll let you know. But you can't do it that way. It has to be said. We have to say it. You know, we wake up every morning and we say Moda Ani. Moda Ani means like, it's basically thank you. It's an acknowledgement. And what are we really saying? You gave me another day. You believe in me. We say, great is your trust, God's trust in us. You trust me with another day. That means you think I can do something good with this day. Thank you. It's the first thing we say when we open our eyes in the morning. Thank you. Acknowledge. That's one level. Let's go a little bit deeper. How do we find joy? Especially when things are just, they're hard. When my kids were little, we went on a trip. And right before we got back in our car to go home, one of my kids, my daughter, she was about six, I think, at that point. We passed a store that sold very interesting t-shirts. And she decided she has to have one of those t-shirts. And we decided, you don't need that t-shirt and the trip is over and everybody get in the car, we're going home. The whole way home was a 2-hour trip. My little girl kept insisting that if we just turn the car around right now and go back and buy the t-shirt, she promises that she will never ask for anything again. And she promises that she will be happy for the rest of her life. Because here's how it works. Sometimes you cannot get what you want. And we think, if I only have this thing, then I could be happy. And sometimes what we want so that we can be happy, it's not an extra like a t-shirt, it's basics. It's health. It's somebody in our lives so we don't be lonely. It's basics. I need this. If I just get what I want or what I need, then I could be happy. But what happens if, sometimes we get it, we're still not happy, but what happens if we cannot get it? Right now, we're living in an exile. It's not messianic times as far as revealed good yet. So we cannot get in this exile world as it is now. Some of us are in a situation where we cannot have what we want. I would like my kids back. In this reality now, we cannot have it. So what happens? How do we find joy when we cannot get what we want? So Avraham Joshua Heschel writes that when a Jew is sad, he cries. When he's even sadder, he's silent. But when he's saddest of all, he sings. When he's saddest of all, he sings. Why? Because singing, a song, is the language of the soul. You ever have that you walk into a wedding or something and there's upbeat music and all of a sudden your whole body is responding? That's from your soul. Your body's reacting to your soul, but your soul is touched. Or a very deep meditative kind of a song. It pulls us in. When a Jew is saddest of all, he sings. Because singing is from the soul. And here's how it works. At its essence, when you go to the very essence, sadness and joy comes from the same place. The greatest sadness that a person can have is sadness of the soul. It's the sadness of a life wasted. It's that we were given a soul and we were given gifts in this world and we didn't accomplish, we didn't get better, we wasted it. Conversely, the greatest joy a person can have is the joy of the soul. We were given a soul, clothed in a body, with talents, with gifts, with circumstances, and we used it to make ourselves better. We used it to make the world better. How do we do it? One word, truth. Truth. When Yossi was a little kid, he loved going rollerblading. I know I'm running out of time. I'm going to wrap up, but he loved to go rollerblading and he was really great at it. He would go whizzing around on the path. We had like a path near the water. And I wanted to go with him, make sure he was safe, but I wasn't all that good at it. So I would be like wobbling and like, you know, just, but I'm trying to keep up with him so that, you know, I don't lose him. And after he died, I actually was doing therapy in a different area, but next to water. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go back and do what I used to do with Yossi. I'm going to go rollerblading just to feel the connection to him. And so I went to this, I brought my blades, I brought my helmet, and I went to this path. And I put on the blades, I put on the helmet. The helmet doesn't fit. It had been a lot of years. I cannot get it on. So I just gave up. Finally, I threw the helmet back in the car and I'm just blading along on the path very badly and wobbling and, you know, a real amateur. And as I'm blading along, I see that the path suddenly goes uphill, pretty steep hill. Now, any dummy knows that if a path is going to go up, it's also going to have to go down. And any dummy knows that if you don't know how to skate very well, and you don't know how to stop, and there's nothing to hold on to, and you're not wearing a helmet, you probably should not go up a hill. But I wasn't thinking clearly, so I went up the hill, and all of a sudden, I'm really in trouble. I'm flying down this hill. Now, this happens faster than it takes to tell it, but I'm flying down this hill, and I'm thinking, I'm not wearing a helmet. I'm going to fall. I'm going to fall. I'm going to fall. At the bottom of the hill, there's a pole. It was probably a sign, but I just remember seeing the pole. And I figured if I can just aim my body towards that pole, I'll grab it and it'll break my fall. Oh. So I aim towards the pole. I hit that pole so hard that I fell backwards and I hit the back of my head. I always say it explains a few things. The first moment was knocked out, like didn't lose consciousness, but like, you know, the wind knocked out of me. And then I thought, okay, let's see. I'm on the ground. The ground is still on the ground. The sky is still up there. Okay, let's get practical. I'm a survivor. What used to work? What still works? I used to be able to move my arms. Can I still move my arms? I tried. Yeah, still move my arm. Used to be able to move my feet. Can I still move my feet? I tried. Yeah, still move my legs. So what used to work still works. So I'm kind of bruised and battered, but I can get up and I can keep going. So I got up, took off the blades, walked back to my car in my socks, 2 miles, and never skated again. But here's what I was thinking as I was walking. Sometimes something happens to us that knocks us off our feet. Happens. Happened to us on October 7th. And many, many, many other times in history, happens to us personally sometimes. And I thought about it that time with Yossi. Got knocked off my feet. For a while, we're not sure what's up, what's down. And then we start to say, okay, let's see what used to work, what still works. And we go to truth. I used to believe in God. Do I still believe in God? I still believe in God. Nothing happens without God. This whole world is God. I used to believe in soul, that our souls exist before they come into this world, that they continue to exist after we leave this world. Do I still believe in soul? Still believe in soul. So what used to work still works. So I'm bruised and I'm battered. We all are. But we can get up. We can keep going. And I'm just going to end with this. People say to me all the time, they say, oh, it's different for you. You were born religious. Or you're very spiritual. Or you're very strong. Or you're very happy. That they know because I wear lipstick. You know, people look at someone else and say, you can do it, but I'm not that. I wasn't born religious. I wasn't, I'm not strong. I'm not happy. But here's really how it works. There is no magical transformation into now I'm happy. Now I'm strong. Now I'm spiritual. It doesn't work like that. After Yossi died, I journaled. And I documented a very, very messy and kind of awful grief journey. I was binging. There was a point where we actually laughed at Yossi's funeral because tears and laughter are so close. And I was not able to sleep. And I had an argument with my husband that I wrote about. I also snapped at someone who asked me how many children I have. It was a messy, inelegant, very, very raw journal, which later became a book. But the bottom line was, as I was journaling, I realized that my own work is happening a little bit at a time. I started it and I was thinking, I don't know how, but somehow the little steps that we make, moment by moment, the choices, that's how we are strong, happy, spiritual. If I don't feel like being very happy today, if I feel like poor me, I can still smile to my husband so I don't ruin his day. If I don't feel generous, I can still give a little bit. If I don't feel spiritual, I can still learn just a bit. And that journal, that messy, messy journal, was my story of how do I connect to other people? How do I relate to someone who hasn't lost most of her kids? I thought I'd never be able to talk to anyone again. How do I relate to a God who I felt kind of kicked me to the side? How do I feel my own strength? And slowly, slowly, I recognized, I named the book, Even If I'm Not, in very short, because I realize I'm over, but that's Even okay. If I'm Not, keep going, okay, because I just wanted to tell you the last thought. When Yossi was a little kid, I was rushing, working mom. I was rushing to get him ready in the morning. And I kind of called over my shoulder and I said, Yossi, there's bagels on the counter if you're hungry. So Yossi, he always did this. He loved words. He said to me, even if I'm not. And I said, what? And he said, he was really young, but he always did these kind of things. He said, well, you said there's bagels on the counter if I'm hungry. The bagels are not on the counter if I'm hungry. The bagels are on the counter, even if I'm not hungry. They're there anyway. So even if I'm not became one of our family lines. He had many of them. But after Yossi died, I realized something. I realized, you know, I was looking. Where do I get strength? Where do I get wisdom? Where do I get comfort? How am I ever going to talk to anybody again? Not be angry at God. Believe that I am still a mom and I can still survive. How am I going to do that? And I recognize slowly, gradually, I came to recognize that it's all there. There's wisdom. There's wisdom in books. There's wisdom in rabbis. There's wisdom. These days, there's so much wisdom that you can access about soul, about God, about how to turn suffering into transcendence. There's wisdom all over. There's comfort, one in the other. We don't have to have gone through the same thing to be able to give comfort. I don't think there's anyone alive today who doesn't know what it's like to feel pain or vulnerability or fear or anxiety or regret or bitterness. And there's strength within us. And I began to recognize that God sets it up for us, that everything that we need, this wisdom, this comfort, this strength, it's all there. It's all ready, even if I'm not. Thank you. Happy to take questions if you'd like. Although people usually need a minute just to breathe.
Wow, that was, I don't have the words to describe that, but it was just powerful. We do have a few minutes. Anyone have any questions? Comments or anything you want?
Yeah, that happens sometimes. People are like, okay, let me breathe. I get that a lot.
So while everyone's thinking, I'll just ask you a quick thing. I know you referenced it at the end, but just maybe just talk about it a little bit more. Just you said that obviously didn't that perspective, which is so unbelievably powerful, didn't just happen overnight. There was a process. There's a lot of journaling. By the way, I do recommend that people get the book. I'll give out the website. It's called Even If I'm Not. It's an incredible book. You can read the whole journal there. One of the things that I found so amazing about that journal, as you put it, is that how honest you were about the pain and the length and the process that it took to get to that perspective. Can you just comment that a little bit? Like, does it take a long time? Are you in therapy? What does it look like, just briefly? I mean, obviously it's not a brief thing, but.
Sure. So I did do a little bit of therapy called EMDR. EMDR uses light. It's called eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. It's a brilliant therapy that uses light, that it helped me just with a trauma reaction, because I kept seeing Yossi in the water and I was like haunted by that. I couldn't see him laughing and the way he used to be. So this is a therapy where you look at light. And I always talk about that, just looking at the light, looking at the godly light in the world, we get what we need. But that was just a brief trauma therapy. Talk therapy didn't work well for me, although sometimes the help really does help. So of course we have things like that to help us through trauma. There's a lot of good techniques in the world and definitely we should use them. But as far as the approach, I was lucky in a way that I knew, because I had gone through it with the babies, I knew that the world of soul exists. I didn't question that God exists. My problem was, how do I make it real? How do I access it? Like, even though I knew God exists and I knew that the soul is doing its work and all that, I was too angry and I was stuck. And the only thing I could say, and that's where the journal was helpful, because I didn't realize it till I looked back, is that it really isn't a transformation that we go from being sad to happy, weak to strong. It isn't like that. It's the little actions. It's like when I wake up one day and I feel like it's hard for me to pray because today I'm feeling sad. Today, something triggered me. And there were so many of them, because, you know, there was the babies and then there was Yossi and other stuff happens in life too. And sometimes I turn to God and I say, really, this you're doing to me now? Because even after the biggies, stuff still happens. Even in my family, stuff still happens. We still get hurt. And what I realized is that I just have to do a small thing. I could say a short prayer. I could say a blessing. I can hold food in my hand and say, thank you, God, for this. This is a gift too. Not everybody has it. Thank you that I can see. So it's really, really, there's no great big transformation. It's very small actions. Smiling at someone when we feel just bitter and angry, holding back a negative comment because it'll hurt somebody else, giving a little bit, even though we feel deprived, learning a little bit. The more we learn just a little bit about God, about soul, about Torah, it gives us not only the strength to continue, but understanding of the bigger picture. Why are we in this world? So when we understand soul and God and what God is asking of us, it helps.
Amazing. Yes, please.
Thank you so much. I don't really have words, but just a thank you to you. Can you talk a bit about kindness to self? It seems like you give a lot about what about kindness to self?
That's a great question. About how do we be kind to ourselves? The first thing I would say, I was lucky, my husband was very supportive, allow it. I think that as a society, I don't know, Australian society as well, but I know in America, when somebody starts to cry, one of the first things people tell them is don't cry. We just do that automatically. So I feel like we almost need permission to feel. Besides, of course, the self-nurturing, people know about that. You have to nurture yourself and all that, but starting with the basics, which is really allow yourself to feel the disappointment. You know, many times when people come up to me, I do a lot of work with loss. So people call me, let's say, when they've lost a baby. And the first thing they do as they're grieving for a baby that's lost is they apologize to me. I know that's coming to you with, quote, just one baby lost when you've lost so much. And to me, it always feels like, why would you even feel like you need to do that? Allow yourself the pain. The fact that someone else has more pain, so what? Right now, you're in pain. If somebody breaks a toe and someone else has a broken leg, we should not invalidate it. And people do it. They do it when they speak to me. They do it themselves too. I should be grateful. You should be grateful, but you're also allowed to feel what you're feeling. If you're feeling anger, allow yourself to look at it and say, why? Why am I angry? I see people that when they, after a loss, are so determined to go on right away or to prove something. And it's very nice to go on. It's very nice to push away anger. And I'm not saying we should go around, you know, raving and yelling at people. But bottom line is, the first and kindest thing you can do to yourself is allow yourself to feel what you're feeling. Disappointment, even in yourself, jealousy, anger. People talk to me many times about jealousy and they say, I must be a terrible person. I can't look at someone who has what I don't have. If it's someone who's not married, I can't look at couples, someone who doesn't have children, or someone who doesn't have a certain type of anything. It's hard for them to look at it. And I always say to them, that's not jealousy. That's pain. That's pain. It's okay. It's okay. It's human not to be able to look at what you want so badly that you don't have. So don't be hard on yourself. Allow yourself the feeling. Besides that, I think allow yourself the time. It's so, so important. And there is help out there. For me, the EMDR was very helpful. There's so many ways to get help. And we're all very individual. And for some people, it's pampering. For some people, it's spiritual. But at least make the room for it. As women especially, I think we're not all that good at it. Men is a separate story because we tend to ask women, we tend to ask men how the women are doing, and we don't even give room for the men altogether to have the feelings. But women in general, we tend to be caretakers. So it's a tricky thing. I see many fathers, by the way, who go through loss, who don't really, are not allowed either to have the space. But women in general, we tend to be nurturers. And if we have other children or other people who rely on us, we, and it is good that we have that. The fact that I became a grandma the week that we finished Kaddish for Yossi, it forced me, I didn't want to be a sad grandma. So it did force me forward, which is very, very healthy. But I also needed to make room for how painful it was. So allow it. That would be the main answer there. Make room for it. Find a way to express it in a healthy way.
I have a question. Thank you, Felicity, very much. It's unbelievable. Sure. But how long past the grieving process, does it ever end? Do you ever get better at using and applying the spirituality that you do?
It's a very good question also. The way it works really, I don't think that you cross a line from, I mean, the first year was very acute. So the journal is really the first year because that was the hardest, all the markers of last year, this time, and the shock because Yossi died suddenly. It was very different than illness. So it was a different process. Like when my babies were sick, every time we went to the hospital and the doctors would come towards us to tell us something, I would have this temptation to just turn around and run away. So it was like 1,000 deaths. It was different. Whereas with Yossi, we were going along perfectly well. And then all of a sudden he died. So the shock took longer. But I would say the first year was really the hardest. And once I started to recognize that I could have moments of okay, and I'm allowed, and I want to put that in also because that's important too. I answered you before that we should make room for our feelings. Sometimes we feel guilty. I remember the first time I laughed and the first time I thought about enjoying something and I felt guilty. I'm grieving. How can I enjoy? Allow it. It comes in bits and pieces. I don't wake up every morning now the way I did that first year, the first year, and start to cry that Yossi's dead and my babies are dead and I can't have any more children and all that. I don't do that anymore. I do carry with me a certain sense of kind of being banged around. I feel like I've been just, you know, that knocked around kind of feeling. I have that. I do. So whenever anything new happens that's disappointing, like one of my kids went through a crisis a few years ago and all the old stuff comes back. That's more how it works. And I'm like, I'm turning to God and saying, you're doing this to me? Really? You're doing this like after this and after that? But I think as a Jewish nation, we have that too. We take a lot of hard knocks. So I would say that after the acute, very, very sharp grief of that first year, where I was lucky enough to have the support and to be able to process it, it comes up as a general sense of being. I feel like a lot happened to me. But the flip side of that, besides the fact that it triggers, and when something triggers, I do have a harder time. I do, because I feel like so much has happened and you're doing this. I do. But the flip side of that, and it's really important to hear this, I have a very deep capacity for joy and for gratitude. I am a really fun grandma. I don't take anything for granted. And you hear this from people all the time. I speak to cancer survivors and they say, I love life. You hear it from people who know how easily we can lose. I don't take it for granted. I'm grateful for my health. Spent a lot of time in hospitals. I'm grateful for my health. I'm grateful for my husband. I'm grateful for my children. I'm grateful for my grandchildren. I am grateful for life, for friendship, for what we have. So it's not like there are sadder and happier people. I think it's a capacity opens within us. Once we're feeling, we're feeling. So I have more joy, I think, than many, many people, because I allow myself that. I don't want to waste life. It's too precious. Other than that, I can just tell you that, yeah, though, I think I will never be the same person I was before I had even, you know, before the first baby died. That's really where I recognize that there's no given. And maybe that makes me more serious and a little bit more wounded. But for the most part, I don't consider myself an unhappy person. So I think it's a process.
All right, thank you so much. We are out of time. I just want to... And I think we can have you back sometime. But I just want to wish you, on behalf of everyone here, just only happiness and only strength.
Thank you.
And just continue inspiring other people. And we're almost about to enter the month of Elul, and we probably won't see you till Rosh Hashanah. So wish you on behalf of everyone a Shana Tova and a really good year ahead for you and for the whole Am Yisrael. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure. Thank you.